When Kane turned back around, he saw Pasht glaring at him. He nodded and caught up.
The underground mazes are going to be the actual resting places of the Pharaoh and his family. When it's completed, the pyramid will have 6 mastabas, each smaller than the other, stacked on top of each other.
Are there any rooms above?
You helped build those mastabas, don't you know?
No.
Pasht drew up suddenly around another corner. She stood in front of a T-intersection. Shoving her torch forward, she cast the light into each passageway. The passageway to the right went up, and the passageway to the left descended at a steep decline. The young woman swung her torch in that direction.
This way.
You're sure?
Pasht went forward without a word, and Kane followed. He felt a sudden sharp pain in his chest and thought for just a moment that he had tripped one of the deadly traps the young woman had mentioned. Then he realized he had to have shifted in his sleep back in the shelter and aggravated the bruising. As he followed Pasht down the underground labyrinth beneath the pyramid, Kane noted that the temperature dropped quickly. The flames of their torches cut through the darkness and guttered slightly as they moved.
The Pharaoh plans to have his mummy buried in the pyramid, but his viscera will be buried in the south tomb.
Why?
As he and Set work to unify the Egyptian lands and make the people better understand the importance of the god kings, they have decided there must also be a unification of the two lands of Upper and Lower Egypt. Having tombs representing both places will satisfy those separate interests.
Suspicion darkened Cain's thoughts when he considered Djoser's decision about the viscera. Was it as simple as satisfying the issue of political boundaries? Or, with Enlil involved, was there something more sinister? Twice, Pasht led them into side rooms while architects and overseers walked past. Even with the torches burning, those people never looked twice. Security was lax. After a few more minutes of traveling through the passageways, Pasht found one that led up again. At the top of the incline, they stepped out into another passageway. Without hesitation, the young woman led the way into a large room.
Sets when they can get away with it. Set and Djoser visit here only occasionally.
Show me where the hidden door is.
We should get out of here. If the overseers find us here, they'll kill us all.
I need to know.
Why do you think you always need to know? Ever since Set first came to visit the Pharaoh, you've been like this. You're not on their level, Kanat. They would destroy you with one look.
Because I don't trust Set.
You're a slave! You're in no position to trust anyone!
Kane clapped the smaller man on the shoulder.
I trust you.
Then he followed Pasht. She led the way into a room to the left. It was long and narrow.
This is the room where Djoser's viscera will be laid to rest in canopic jars.
At present, the room was empty.
What about the hidden room?
Pasht hesitated a moment, then walked to the wall on the right. She began at the right side where the wall butted into the next. Kneeling, she counted rows of stones.
The release is 8 stones up and 33 stones over.
She used both hands to push the stone she isolated from all the rest. A click echoed throughout the burial chamber.
Oh, preserve us.
Suddenly, a section of the wall folded back, revealing a chamber within. Pasht moved forward cautiously.
There!
Her torch illuminated the room and glittered against metal and glass surfaces. Surprise showed on her face.
What is it?
Kane stepped in behind her and raised his own torch until the flames touched the ceiling. The device sat on a flat table. It was something less than 3 feet tall and no more than 2 feet deep and 2 feet wide. A curved metal surface shaped like an upside-down bowl covered the top of the machine. 2 smaller bowls, these right side up, occupied space under the much larger bowl on top. Glass tubing connected all the bowls, then ran down into a basket below. The device looked incredibly simple, but the tubing was twisted into arcane shapes. Pasht shook her head.
I don't know. This has never been here before.
Suddenly she froze, her mouth halfway open as if to say something else.
Pasht.
The young woman didn't answer. Kane stepped closer to her and put an arm out to touch her.
Pasht.
Her flesh felt cool and dry to his touch, despite the fact that he could see perspiration gleaming on her. She also felt as stiff and as immobile as a statue. The skin at the back of Kane's neck tightened. He looked at her torch and saw that even the flames had stopped moving, though they remained as bright as ever. He looked to his own torch and saw the same thing had happened. Cautiously, he reached up and touched the torch flames. The light in the room remained, but only some of the heat.
Cain.
Recognizing the voice, Cain turned swiftly. A strange figure stood in the doorway leading to the tomb proper. He stood less than 5 feet tall and possessed a slender build. His head was a round, bald dome, but his features were sharp, primarily all cheek and forehead, with pale grayish-pink skin stretched tightly over them. His eyes were two great hollows in his face, seemingly depthless. His mouth was a slit over a weak-looking chin. He wore gray robes and knitted his six-fingered hands before him. Cain called the creature by name.
Balaam.
Balaam was the last of the Archons, the last of the children Enlil had created from the two alien races that had come to Earth and turned it into a battleground until they had almost wiped each other out.
Do you remember this place?
Balaam waved his hands at the room.
No.
But you are here now. So if you are here now, then you must have been there then.
The logic was confusing, but Cain knew better than to argue with it.
Where am I?
In the past, in Egypt, land of the pyramid builders. It looks as though it was a very interesting period in your culture's history.
I wouldn't know.
Cain tossed the torch away to free his hands and wished he had a weapon. He didn't fear Balaam because the Archon had never tried to injure him and had even helped him on occasion. But wherever Balaam turned up, danger seemed to follow. Did that hold true if Balaam turned up in the past? Cain wondered. He glanced down at the frozen flames of the rush torch and guessed that it was entirely possible. As he turned back to Balaam, he saw the Archon waver out of sight for a moment, then pop back and become clear again.
You should know since you were here.
I was never here. I'm not sure I'm here now. This could be a fever dream.
And if it is, he thought, I'm talking to myself. Balaam approached the machine in the center of the room. He stepped around Bakari, who also stood frozen, to get there.
Don't overly concern yourself about the fever, Cain. The fever is merely your body's reaction to the stress I put in your mind under to remember these things.
What things?
This machine, for one.
Cain looked at the dormant machine.
Why should I be interested in this machine?
Because later, Cain, you will make a promise about this machine, and you will make an enemy.
He touched the machine, but his hand passed through it, not capable of physical contact.
I'm not here, but I have a connectivity to this place through you, and through others.
What is this machine?
The machine didn't look like much, but anything the Archons were involved with was always much more than it appeared to be. His experiences with the Chintamani Stone were proof enough of that.
It is a machine of great power.
Cain felt himself growing irritated at the response.
That's not an answer.
Now is not the time for all answers, Cain. You will be shown the things you need to know as you need to know them. Rest assured of that. This journey that you're on has been predetermined by your promise and by who you are.
Is Enlil here? Is he set?
Balaam hesitated for a moment. Enlil's hand had guided the birth of the Archons, and Balaam still had ties to that, as well as emotional complexities of his own.
The Enlil that was is the Enlil that you have seen here, but he is not the Enlil that now is.
I don't understand.
You will, Cain, in time.
Balaam stretched out a hand, and light seemed to radiate in his palm.
You can find all the answers.
Cain reached for Balaam's hand, meaning to brush it aside and keep the bright light from burning into his eyes. Only his hand passed through the Archons. Balaam faded before him, and the torch in Pasht's hand suddenly wavered again. The young woman turned to him with a worried look.
Kanak, are you all right?
Cain tried to answer, though he didn't know what he was going to say, but Bakari interrupted.
Someone's coming! I hear them!
Turning, Cain heard them too.
Douse the torches.
Cain moved quickly to step on the one he'd carried in. The flames went out reluctantly, and embers flew into the air. Thankfully, they quickly extinguished. Pasht wrapped her own torch in her shift and extinguished it with the sweat-soaked material. Cain grabbed both extinguished torches and followed Pasht out of the room. She tapped the recessed stone again, and the hidden door swung closed.
There's another way!
Kane reached back for Bakari, grabbing him by the shoulder and yanking him from the hidden room with only inches to spare. Pasht led them to the other side of the temple area as the footsteps continued to come closer and the voices grew louder. She knelt on the floor and pulled at one of the large stones.
Here! The overseers know about this place. Imhotep and Djoser and even Set think they have secrets in these places, but there are few that the overseers don't know.
Kane joined her and had trouble jamming his fingers into the small crevice that separated the stone from the others. Even when he had managed a grip, he found the stone was incredibly heavy. When he shoved it aside, he could barely make out the round entrance to a passageway.
What is this?
An escape route.
Where does it go?
Out! Does it matter? If we get caught, they'll kill us!
She slid over the edge and dropped down. Kane followed her and found a ledge at the passageway's edge that allowed him to stand and reach the stone overhead. Bakari hesitated above. Kane reached up and grabbed the man by the hair and yanked him down to the escape tunnel, clapping his other hand over Bakari's mouth.
Quiet! You'll get us all killed!
Bakari nodded. Kane released the man, then quickly stood and replaced the stone over the passageway entrance. They were sealed in utter darkness as footsteps resonated in the temple above. Then a light flared in the darkness, revealing a middle-aged man holding a small torch in one hand and a curved dagger in the other. A young woman lay in the passageway behind him, hurriedly putting her clothing back on. The man was dressed in the uniform of an overseer. A whip lay coiled on the ground next to him. He smiled as he looked at the three new arrivals.
You three are surely in trouble.
Then he looked at Kane, and some of the arrogant demeanor slipped. He peered more closely. The torchlight glared into Kane's eyes. He held up a palm to shield it from his face, but somehow the harsh light seemed to bend around his hand, growing brighter and brighter.
Do I know you?
Kane's eyes teared, and his vision misted as the light continued increasing. In a heartbeat, he couldn't see anything but the light, and pain exploded in his head.
Kane! Is that you? Kane!
The name came to Harry Lindstrom's lips unbidden as he stared at the young slave illuminated by the torch in front of him. A wave of nausea swept through him as he settled more firmly into the dream, but he kept focused on the young slave. Did dark recognition spark in those eyes? The young woman with the slave quickly stepped behind him. Obviously, she was afraid of being recognized. It could only mean that whoever Lindstrom was in this life had known her. But from the look he'd gotten of her, he would have sworn he'd never seen her in his life.
Kane!
Lindstrom peered around quickly, not wanting to take his eyes from the young slave in front of him. They were in a passageway, and it was one of the smallest ones he'd seen in the pyramids. That meant it was probably one of the secret tunnels under the lowest mastaba. The thinner man of the two threw himself to the floor.
Oh, please! I ask your forgiveness, Overseer. We were traveling through the passageways doing our work and became lost.
Lindstrom ignored the scared slave and kept his eyes on the other man. The glacial and predatory set of the man's features was warning enough that he was capable of immediate violent behavior. A thought stirred in the back of Lindstrom's mind, letting him know that if the slave did take such action, it was punishable by death. Would Kane know that? Lindstrom wondered. Or would the man care? He wasn't certain. He'd only met Kain a time or two in his dreams, and he'd never really learned much about the man. However, Lindstrom was certain that Kain was real, because the Holy Grail was real. Lindstrom tried again.
Kain!
The young man shook his head.
My name is Kanacht.
Lindstrom moved closer, pushing his torch toward the young man. The spark of recognition he'd seen in the man's eyes had disappeared.
What were you doing here?
Overseer, we were lost.
No, I don't believe you.
Kanacht didn't reply.
Honestly, Overseer, it was a mistake. We...
You were here to look at the machine, weren't you?
Kanacht shook his head.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Lindstrom gripped his knife more tightly and felt the black rage that often overcame him in the dreams seethe through him. Vasquez had accused him of not acting quickly enough earlier in the day, but in his dreams, he always acted immediately.
Yes, you do.
No. I came here with a woman, the same as you did. It was hot outside, and I've been worked too hard lately.
It was no use, Lindstrom realized. Kane, if he'd ever truly been there, was gone. He blew his breath out in a great gust that echoed through the passageway.
Get out of here.
The skinny slave pushed himself to his feet in a heartbeat.
Which way is the quickest?
Lindstrom pointed his torch at the other end of the passageway. The skinny man started down it immediately, catching the young woman's hand in his and pulling her along into the darkness. The other young man backed away, keeping his eyes on Lindstrom and his hands out to his sides. That way, he remained ready. He didn't trust Lindstrom. Kane doppelgangers always exhibited such control and awareness. Lindstrom held his torch high for a time, watching them go until they disappeared from the light. Embers flew from the rush torch he carried, spiraling down and extinguishing before they touched the ground. He felt the loneliness and loss, as he always did when such a close encounter with Kane happened in the dreams and ended so unsatisfactorily.
Hey, Kane!
Slowly, Lindstrom turned to the slave woman he'd brought down into the secret tunnel with him. She was young and lovely, as were nearly all of the women that he brought inside the pyramid with him. Her mouth was a little large, perhaps, but that had been diverting, he well recalled. Even though she had wrapped herself and covered her nudity, the torchlight revealed the small, sleekly rounded flesh of her thighs and calves.
What are you going to do about them, Hekaid?
Lindstrom tried to recall her name. Sometimes he could remember things from the memory of who he had been at that time, but he couldn't recall this woman's name. And it didn't matter.
I'm not going to do anything about them.
Lindstrom took a firmer grip on the knife and started toward her. He held the torch to the side so her eyes were focused on it instead of the knife.
You're going to let them sneak around the Pharaoh's secrets and let them go unpunished? They're common slaves, Hekaid. They'll tell everyone what they've done, and then the Pharaoh will have no secrets left.
Lindstrom knew that wasn't true. Kane and whoever the other man had been wouldn't tell anyone anything. Kane never did, no matter where the dreams in time took them. And the woman already knew about the secret chamber. The only real danger lay in the woman at his feet. She would tell others that he had let Kane and his companions go, and that would be dangerous to him. He hung the torch on the sconce on the wall and, smiling a little, held his hand out.
Come. We can't spend any more time here, in case they get caught.
I still don't understand why you didn't kill them. You had a knife, they didn't. I know you weren't afraid of Kana.
No, I wasn't afraid of him.
He drew her close to him, and she came a little timidly. Although he couldn't remember their encounter in the passageway because his arrival in the memory had started too late in his dream, he knew they'd been having sex. At Sumeriumville, he hadn't been able to find someone else who drew out his baser side. His occasional flings with other archivists were extremely limited and less than fulfilling. It hadn't been until he encountered Narita Vasquez that he had found someone who could meet him desire for desire. Still, he enjoyed the dreams he had of past women he'd slept with. But he never told Vasquez.
Let's get out of here.
Lindstrom pulled her forward with his left hand so he could fall in behind her. She glanced at him nervously as she walked, as if she might have known what was on his mind. Lindstrom only smiled reassuringly at her, then tightened his grip on the knife. When she turned to look forward again, he stepped forward hurriedly and clapped his hand over her mouth. She grabbed his restraining hand with both of hers, and he had to knock them out of the way when he used the knife to slash her throat. The woman kicked and fought as she struggled to free herself, but that only added to the way her heart frantically pumped her lifeblood from her. In less than a minute, she'd bled out and lay lifeless in his arms. Lindstrom cleaned himself up with her clothing, wiping the blood from both arms as he squatted beside her. This was one thing Vasquez didn't know about him, and Lindstrom had taken pains to see that she didn't. Killing was easy for him. He'd spent decades and centuries at it, if he was to believe the dreams he'd had all his life. When he practiced with Vasquez, when he killed with her, it was only working to remember an acquired skill. The passion to kill had always been there. He remained in the passageway for a time and knew that this dream sequence was going to be an important one. There was going to be something more for him here than normal. Seeing Kane here, even for only that brief flickering moment, had guaranteed that. The torch finally guttered a last time and went out, leaving him in the darkness. Lindstrom thought that he might leave the dream then, because there were a number of places to hide the woman's body, and he knew he probably wouldn't get named as her killer anyway. He listened to the sound of his own breathing, intermingling with the sharp, muffled voices coming from above. He recognized Joser's voice easily, but he also recognized Set's. Enlil's, he told himself. He knew that his past was inextricably linked with Enlil's, although he couldn't remember why. Finally, when the voices faded and disappeared, Lindstrom put a hand out and dragged his fingertips along the ceiling of the passageway. He located the trapdoor by touch, stepped up onto the ledge, and shoved the heavy stone from the passageway's mouth. His breath quickened when he hauled himself up into the temple, and his heart thudded rapidly in his chest. He wondered how long it had been since he'd seen the complete machine in a dream. Months, at the very least, had passed. He studied the temple, remembering now how he'd been there when the secret room had been built. He also remembered how it was opened. Quietly, conscious of other voices still drifting through Joser's pyramid, Lindstrom made his way to the wall on the opposite side of the room. He counted the stones, quickly finding the one that triggered the door. Lindstrom searched along the wall until he found a pile of rush torches that he knew would be there. With all the construction going on inside and below the pyramid, torches were replenished by slaves daily. He retreated down the hallway leading to the temple until he found the short remains of the torch the last visitor had used, hanging in the wall sconce. He lit his own torch from that and returned to the hidden room. He stared at the machine, and its otherworldly beauty took his breath away. He surveyed the bowls and the tubing, remembering every curving line and feature. So much power was contained within the device, and it was all power that he was determined to have. Hesitantly, Lindstrom walked toward the machine, breathing shallowly in his excitement now. He stretched out a hand toward the top bowl of the machine, his fingers trembling in anticipation.
Grail, food of the gods, ambrosia.
When the machine had been hidden from human hands and scattered across the earth much later, it had been taken apart in three pieces. The top section, the large bowl that sat over the other two bowls, had been the hardest to find throughout the history open to Lindstrom. He touched the top bowl, seeking the resonance he hoped to find within it. His fingertips registered the humming vibration within the strange silvery metal glass that was like nothing else on the earth. In some of the moments in the pasts he'd visited, he'd talked with people who thought the machine was of divine origin, if not extraterrestrial. There were also some who believed it had been smithed by a process that had been forgotten, and others swore the unknown metal had come from the meteor that had smacked into the earth millions of years ago and killed off all the dinosaurs. Lindstrom didn't know and didn't care. All that mattered was that the machine worked. His fingertips grazed the cool metal surface that oozed and shifted beneath them. The metal was hard, nearly indestructible, yet it gave at his touch. Electricity flared from the metal bowl and arced to his fingers. The spark lit up the whole room and knocked Lindstrom backward. He stumbled for 5 or 6 steps, then caught his balance. Fiery comets, blazing golden and blue, orbited within the metal for a moment. He gazed at them, and suddenly the world he perceived around him shifted and took a sudden, hard turn to the left. Black-clad men ran everywhere in front of Lindstrom. He stood transfixed in a narrow metal corridor looking at an elliptical door. Water swirled around his ankles, cold and smelling of the salty sea. An officer shouted, waving his hand for effect.
Get out!
He was clad in black as well, but the cut of his clothing denoted his station. Lindstrom concentrated. Usually, a dream within a dream meant something, brought special knowledge of the machine that he wanted. Men yelled and ran around him. He was nearly knocked down twice. He turned, trying to figure out where he was, trying to figure out who the men were. Before he could guess, one of the men grabbed him by the front of the black uniform he wore. His, he noticed then, was different from the uniforms of the other men. Where they wore common blouses and baggy pants, his uniform was crisp and clean. There was a scarlet band around his left upper arm. There, on a field of white, the right-angled arms of a swastika stood out boldly. The Germans, Lindstrom thought. I'm with the Germans. He stumbled through the narrow corridor after the man who pulled him. However, the man's actions caused the person Lindstrom visited mentally to draw his sidearm. He wasn't surprised to see the Luger clenched in his fist. He'd dreamed of the German Nazis before. The man grew wide-eyed, looking at the pistol suddenly thrust into his face. He released Lindstrom and held up his hands.
No!
Never dare touch me again. I am one of the Führer's select men. I'm sorry, Captain, but we must hurry to other parts of the boat. With this section taking on water as it is, the crew will shut it off from the rest of the boat. I don't know how extensive the damage is.
Boat? Lindstrom glanced around. For all intents and purposes, he was in a long, narrow corridor. Great engines on either side of him filled the walls. Steel encased him like a tomb, and the realization sent a sudden stab of fear shooting through him. He had been here before. Perhaps this was the first time in a dream, but he had been there before.
Captain, I beg you, this is no time to stand and do nothing. The commander of this boat will not hesitate to save this vessel or his men, no matter who you are, even at the cost of our own lives.
Lindstrom knew the man spoke the truth. He holstered his pistol as klaxons sounded around him. Had they already been blaring? He suddenly wasn't sure. Red lights flickered on the narrow walls, flooding the narrow corridor with crimson light. The water at his ankles suddenly surged, rising nearly to his knees. The cold bit deeply into his flesh.
We're sinking.
The other man glanced at the water worriedly.
We're taking on water. It may only be this compartment, or one or two compartments next to it. But the boat commander has given the order to clear this one. We must go.
Lindstrom nodded, suddenly afraid of the water. He had died in the dreams before, and those memories remained some of the strongest within him. He had been shot and slashed with a sword, and his head burst open like an overripe melon with a cudgel. But he had never before drowned. He followed the man forward, slogging through the water. Something bumped into him. When he turned, he found himself staring down at a dead man. The seaman's face and upper body were badly burned, and one of his eyes had filmed over and bubbled up like an egg white on a sunny-side-up order. A jagged piece of metal protruded from his throat. A barrage of explosions suddenly sounded muffled and far away, but the boat jerked in response. Lindstrom fell, submerging for a moment before he was able to find solid footing and push himself back up. He gasped. The shock of the cold water in his face had seized up his lungs. The man in front of him struggled, trying to push the floating corpse from him. Grimly aware that he didn't know his way through the vessel, Lindstrom reached down and plucked the other man from beneath the corpse. The man spluttered, and water, painted the color of blood by the flashing red light, cascaded down his face. He pointed ahead.
The control room! We have to get to the control room!
Metal clanged behind Lindstrom and echoed through the boat. Turning, Lindstrom glanced at two men sealing a compartment door behind him.
It's the electric motor room! They have to seal it off, otherwise the salt water from the sea will hit the battery's acid and create chlorine gas. If the boat fills with the gas, we're all dead.
Lindstrom nodded and shoved the man forward. They ran through the deepening water. The heat of the great engines laboring on either side of him basted him, and their throbbing beat a dizzying crescendo into his head. How could men live like this? Another salvo of explosions sounded, and the resulting shockwave knocked them from their feet again.
The damned British are getting closer with their depth charges again. They have found us now.
He pushed himself forward again, moving toward the compartment hatch. Just before they reached the hatch, someone closed it.
No! We are in here! Let us out! You will kill us!
Panicked now, Lindstrom shoved the man out of the way and seized the great wheel on the door himself. He threw his weight into the effort of turning it, but got nowhere. The door had been locked down from the other side. The boat rocked again, nearly twisting on its side this time. The water level rose even more dramatically. When Lindstrom turned to gaze back at the giant diesel engines, the flickering red lights showed a half dozen new leaks that jetted water into the compartment from the walls and the ceiling. The cold seawater roiled and rushed in.
Plug the leaks! Plug the leaks!
Lindstrom watched seven other men in the compartment, hardly more than shadows in the uncertain red light, stagger through the rising water and begin working on the leaks. All their efforts, he knew, were doomed to failure. Every man in that compartment was a dead man, unable to halt the encroachment of the sea.
Help me! Help me!
Lindstrom wondered how he knew for a certainty that they were all going to die. Perhaps he had dreamed the dream before, or perhaps he had dreamed similar circumstances. In other dreams, he had walked through different parts of World War II, but it had always pertained to the recovery of the machine. Until the nuke cost that caused Skydark, that war had been the worst ever fought. He knew the machine had to have been the reason he was there on that boat now. There'd been a reason back then, and there was a reason now. The water continued to rise, growing deeper and colder. He felt his body begin to grow numb, his teeth chattered, and he started gasping for his breath. Perhaps some of the chlorine gas created by the salt water reaching the battery acid had invaded the room. Chlorine gas, he knew, was heavier than air and would lie along the floor. However, the rising water would push it up. In long minutes, the water rose to his mid-chest, then began creeping up, crawling up across his shoulders and up to his chin. The other men panicked around him. They cursed and screamed and cried, calling on God to spare them. Lindstrom tried to keep himself calm. He had died before. This time would be no different. Only a little longer in the coming, perhaps. That was another thing that Narita Vasquez didn't understand about him. He didn't fear death. Sometimes he wondered if the life he was living with her now was only one more memory, one more dream. A short time later, the boat, he still wasn't sure what boat it was, shifted again, settling on its side. The booming depth charges sounded farther off, and though the concussive waves slammed into the boat, there was less reaction aboard it. The boat was sinking, Lindstrom realized. Then the water closed over his head. He tried to hold his breath, and did for a while, but in the end there was no way he could survive. He kept hoping that he would fade from the dream. Then he took his first deep breath, and the cold salt water invaded his body, burning his nose and the back of his throat. He coughed, then threw up, vomiting out into the invading ocean. Despite himself and the calmness he tried to hang on to, he opened his mouth to scream. Found himself panting weakly in the secret room in the Pharaoh's temple. Lindstrom stared at the machine in front of him. The blue and gold comets whirling within the otherworldly glass metal dimmed, then finally faded entirely. He panted, feeling his thundering heart finally starting to slow. Only then did he realize that he no longer felt that he was alone. He spotted his own shadow, stretched long and lean before him, draped across the machine. The only way he realized that he could see his shadow before him while he held the torch in one hand was if someone was standing behind him. He turned slowly, the skin at the base of his skull tightening and burning. Enlil stood there, in his guise as Set, and pyramid guards flanked him, their weapons drawn.
What are you doing?
Enlil's reptilian gaze was cold and forceful. Lindstrom said nothing. There was nothing he could say after being caught so red-handed. And what had he learned? He took a step back instinctively, looking for a way out. His free hand fell to the knife at his waist. Enlil waved for the guard to stay put, then walked into the secret chamber.
What are you doing?
Before he knew it, Lindstrom's back was against the wall. He set himself, then tossed the torch aside because he no longer needed it with all the other torches in the room. The light flickered along the knife blade.
Stay back.
Enlil cocked his elongated head to the left and gazed into Lindstrom's eyes.
What do you know about the machine? Nothing. You lie. And you don't lie very well.
He snapped his arm out without warning, blocking Lindstrom's knife to one side so that he could strike with his other hand. The talons at the ends of his fingers drove deeply into Lindstrom's skull. Lindstrom felt the talons cleave his skull, feeling like daggers wedging their way through the bone and into the brain behind. A heated paralysis filled him, but he didn't know if it was from the wound to his brain or if it was some power of Enlil's.
Who sent you?
Enlil tore his bloody hand back. Lindstrom tried to answer but couldn't. He wasn't sure if his mouth had opened. A bloody flap of skin hung down into his left eye and obscured his vision. Enlil drew his other hand back to strike. Helplessly, Lindstrom watched the blow approaching. He heard himself screaming in his own mind. Then, suddenly, his arms worked again, and he lashed out. His fist caught flesh in the sudden darkness. He drew back his fist to strike again, his breath exploding in his lungs. He was suddenly aware that he was lying on his back, and that someone else was atop him. He punched again, but this time the blow was painfully blocked outward, causing his wrist to go numb instantly. Before he could recover, a revolver barrel pressed against his face, digging into his left cheekbone.
You stoop bastard! Hit me again and I'll fucking chill you!
Heart pounding frantically, Lindstrom lay back on the bed. He was tense, only then realizing he was in the middle of having sex. Vasquez sat atop him, her thighs on either side of his hips, as she took him deeply inside her. Her juices cooled across his lower stomach and loins as she remained motionless, except for the slight quivering of the blaster barrel against his cheekbone.
I didn't mean to hit you. I thought you were someone else.
Lindstrom's eyesight adjusted, making the most of the lit candles sitting on the windowsills. Her face was cold and devoid of softness, looking hard and merciless as brass in the candlelight. Her arm was steady. Only the barrel shook softly. Lindstrom tasted blood inside his cheek. The pain there became a dull ache, blasting into his face bones. She knew about his dreams. He'd told her about them. But he also knew there'd be no excuse for hitting her. The Outlands were harsh and fierce, and the way she'd been raised and treated as a young girl in Louisiana would have killed most children.
No one hits me. Every man that ever hit me has died. I started that tradition with my father.
Rage glimmered in her eyes for a moment.
I'm sorry.
You're a dead man, Harry. All I have to do is squeeze this trigger to make it happen.
Lindstrom swallowed hard, knowing there was no argument he could offer that would stay her hand if she chose to pursue that course of action. He resisted the impulse to ball a fist, knowing it would have alerted her and probably made the decision for her. Silently, still holding the .38 Chief Special against his face, Vasquez pulled up and disengaged their sexes. She threw a leg over the side of the bed and got to her feet, keeping the blaster shoved against his face.
This is one of those times, Harry, that I regret letting you live.
Lindstrom waited, remembering how coldly and dispassionately he'd killed the young woman in the passageway beneath Joser's pyramid. Maybe he should never have become involved with Vasquez. Yet at the same time, he realized that without her, he would have never gotten the two pieces of the machine that he had, nor would he have been able to organize Campecheville as he had. He waited, as tensely as a coiled spring.
I hate you, Harry Lindstrom. I hate you with everything that I am. Not for hitting me, but for making me live with what I'm about to do.
Lindstrom considered his chances, knowing it was only slightly possible that he could knock the pistol away before she shot him. A thousand things went through his mind in that moment. Images from past dreams of what had possibly been past lives trickled through his mind. There was also a lot of pleading for his life. But in the end, he trusted what he knew to be true about her. There was no other choice. Even if he knocked the pistol away, there was a good chance she would kill him anyway with some other weapon she had. Or he would have to kill her and explain her absence to Wei Qiang's men, who had come in late last night. Despite everything else he knew to be true about her, she loved him. He stared into her eyes, willing her to put down the pistol.
And I hate myself a little, too, because I put myself into this position.
Lindstrom forced his breath out. Slowly, as if not trusting him and not happy with herself, Vasquez pulled the .38's muzzle away. Then she eased the hammer back down and lowered the pistol to her side. Lindstrom gazed at her, seeing her lithe body, the high, conical breasts, and the generous flare of her hips. She kept her pubic thatch neatly trimmed so that the lips of her sex could be seen clearly. The glistening there revealed how much she had wanted him. Her perspiration-streaked body glimmered in the candlelight.
Good night, Harry.
She backed out of the door and stepped out of sight through the doorway. He didn't even hear the padding of her feet as she walked down the hallway.
Don't come after me.
Lying in bed, Lindstrom became aware of the aching need he had for her, and he became aware of the black anger that filled him at the thought of her pinning him to the bed and threatening to kill him. He rose from the sweat-dampened sheets they had twisted about themselves. He tried to remember the physical encounter that had been going on before the dream. Maybe there hadn't been one. Maybe Vasquez had simply crawled on top of him while he slept. It wouldn't have been the first time. Sex with him was different for her, she'd told him that. And he suspected it was because she came closer to giving something of herself away that she'd fought for and protected for years. Nude, he walked out onto the small balcony and stood in the cool wind sweeping in from the bay of Campecheville. Farther out into the bay, boats marked with lanterns moved back and forth across the gentle waves rolling into land. Farther inland, protected by a sand and rock bar that the Ville's inhabitants had made at his instruction, was a small lagoon that held fishing boats, as well as the tugs that toiled night and day. This night, it also held the Tong's two prop-driven airwags that looked like fragile crimson dragonflies and rocked on long, narrow pontoons. The Tong advance representatives had easily acquiesced to his invitation to spend the night at the Ville, Their reluctance had been carefully weighed, and they made just enough noise that it hadn't seemed too easy. Lindstrom had no doubts that the men would scout around the vill. Despite Vasquez's suggestion to keep the Tong men confined and under guard, Lindstrom had posted no such orders. There was nothing to hide in Campecheville except what he chose to hide, and that stayed very well hidden. Only Vasquez knew. Moonlight streaked the partially cleared streets, and he watched cats chasing rats near piles of rubble that had to be hauled off to dump sites in the next few days. There were, he noticed with satisfaction, more lights in the windows of the buildings that had survived the nuke cost now than there had been even a month ago. Vasquez was right, and Reynolds had been right as well. Feeding all the slaves he was buying or accepting immigrants from the American coastline had always been hard. Now the expanding numbers were making that even more impossible. But he believed he could do it. Nothing else was acceptable. All he needed was the third part of the machine. Over the past few years, he'd found two of them, and he'd gotten them through the Mattrans unit he discovered in Campecheville and brought back online. Timing was becoming critical, but he was certain he was closer to the revelation of the third piece of the machine. When he had found the earlier two pieces, the dreams had increased in frequency and intensity, just as they were doing now. And now, just as then, he'd found Cain in his dreams. But would he be a friend or a foe? That remained to be seen. It always did. Harsh sunlight struck Cain when he woke, burning through his eyelids in violent reds. He felt the dull remnants of a headache, and his throat was parched. Voices, grumbling and tired, created an undercurrent of noise around him, and the smell of cooking meat filled his nose. He opened his eyes slowly, slitting them so he could ascertain where he was. It was an old magistrate practice that he knew he'd never get over. Everything looked normal, though. The people they'd rescued were huddled around small cook fires. Early dawn stained the eastern skies, barely lightening the thick fog bank that had settled over the area. The previous night's acid rainstorm lingered in the stench that filled the air and the occasional sting of drops that landed on the people hunkered below.
Are you awake?
Lifting his head from the hillside, feeling how stiff and achy he was from the position he'd been forced into during the night, Cain looked over to his left at Bridget. She sat cross-legged only a few feet away.
Feeling better?
Yeah.
You ran a fever most of the night.
Cain nodded carefully, feeling the pain still throbbing in his temples.
I don't think I have it now, Baptiste.
No, it broke about an hour ago.
You've been watching over me.
Bridget didn't say anything.
Did you get any sleep, Baptiste?
Cain forced himself to his feet.
Some. Enough. Watch out for the branches above your head. They collected a lot of acid rainwater last night that hasn't dried out yet. A couple of people got burns from it this morning when they weren't paying attention to what they were doing.
Cain stayed low enough to avoid contact with the sheltering barrier.
What's the sit rep, Baptiste?
Bridget nodded out toward the cook fires.
Grant and Domi found a nest of squirrels about 100 yards away on the other side of this hill. The two young boys in the group went with them when they found out they were going hunting. They've been bringing back the kills.
Nobody else is in the area with us, then?
Everybody last night would have had sense to get in out of the rain.
Except the rider on the motorcycle. Unless I hallucinated that.
He thought about the dream he'd had, realizing that a hallucination might have covered all of it. But it was strange that there appeared to be no after-effects of the fever, and no other symptoms of sickness either.
No, that was real.
Where did the rider go?
Down the road.
Alone?
I think so. If the rider was an advance scout for a group, Grant or Domi would have seen them. They went out looking for them this morning, which is how we ended up with the squirrel feast. We've got breakfast for the morning, Cain, but we're out of food. The slavers' packs had some, the ones that were recovered, but those people ate it. And I wouldn't have tried to take it away from them yesterday.
It would have caused a fight. Someone might have been killed.
I know. But now that I'm looking at those people, I realize we've taken on a lot of responsibility.
Cain almost grinned at her, but knew better. He looked away, watching the ex-slaves gather around the cook fires and prepare their own meals.
Freeing them yesterday was a good idea.
I know, But now I understand a little better why you and Grant are a little more reluctant to get involved in other people's problems. The next problem is to figure out when to let go.
There's only two decisions regarding that, Baptiste. You let them go when they're able to handle being on their own, or you let them go when you have to.
Bridget handed a sharpened stick and several squirrels to Kane.
You can skin and roast your breakfast. If it hadn't rained last night, we could have gathered berries and nuts from the bushes and trees. A lot grows around here, foraging materials mostly. But the acid rain from last night will make them inedible for a while. We're going to have problems with a water supply, though. Whatever natural water was in the area will be contaminated after last night's rain. The last of what we've had has already been used this morning.
Does anyone know how far it is to Fiddlerville?
I've asked a couple of others, but they all say the same thing.
That Fiddlerville isn't far?
Right. None of them have ever even been there, Kane. Maybe it doesn't even exist.
Did you read any records at Cerberus about Fiddlerville?
Kane knew all about Bridget's memory, and he knew if the ville had been mentioned, she would remember it. Added to that was Lakesh's own driving need to know more about everything, so it was surprising when Bridget shook her head.
For all we know, it's a myth. Something to give these people hope.
Kane looked to the south, followed the curve of the rutted road they had been following.
We'll know soon enough, Baptiste.
There are going to be other slavers. In fact, the whole myth of Fiddlerville could be a trap.
I know, but we can't stay here, and going back isn't any more attractive than going forward. We'll keep going. We haven't been that way yet.
Kane sat on his haunches and pinched meat from the roasted squirrel while he held the spit he had cooked it on. The flavor was slightly gamey, but the meat helped fill his belly. Metal clanked around him as two of the men used hammers they had taken from the dead slavers to remove the iron slave collars from the others. Counting Angel and Cherub, there were 16 ex-prisoners in the group. The five children among them, including Cherub, were restless and anxious to go. All of them were thirsty. Glancing up to the right, Kane spotted Bridget keeping watch high on the hillside next to a gnarled sycamore tree. She had gotten good at keeping herself concealed. Finished with the squirrel, Kane used his M14 to push himself to his feet, then made his way up the hill to join Bridget. When she looked at him, wary hostility was evident in her emerald green eyes.
Did you come up here to take over watch?
Kane subdued the immediate feelings of irritation that swelled within him. There were times when the chemistry between himself and Bridget Baptiste was difficult to handle. Both of them were too independent to get along easily much of the time.
No, Baptiste, I didn't.
Kane sat gingerly, mindful of the throbbing ache that had ballooned up inside his chest after he'd gotten up and started moving around. A brief inspection of his chest earlier had shown that his whole upper body was covered in deep purple bruising.
I came up to talk.
Grant and Domi were on the other side of the trail. If anyone approached, they would have a chance to put him or her into a crossfire. Kane and Grant had talked briefly and decided that it was in their best interests for the slaves to remove their collars. That way, maybe they wouldn't be an open invitation to the next slavers that came along. Bridget seemed surprised.
What do you want to talk about?
After only a moment's hesitation, Kane told Bridget about his two dreams of Egypt. Bridget spoke after Kane had finished.
Djoser was an important pharaoh. He was part of what scholars termed the Third Dynasty. There were actually four dynasties during the time of Egypt's Old Kingdom. During that period, governments became centralized and administrative systems came into being. There were also dramatic increases in technology, building, hieroglyphic writing, and art.
Kane thought of Enlil.
Like someone was guiding them along.
The campsite was 10 minutes back along the rutted road they followed south. The forest stayed thick on either side of the road, which was why Grant and Domi walked the wing positions. No one would be able to slip up on the group with them watching, and they could range ahead to scout out the new territory. Kane walked point with Bridget.
Back before Skydark, there were many archaeologists and other historians who believed the ancient Egyptians had contact with aliens. The Maya, as well as Native Americans, were thought to have traveled across the Bering Strait and settled into North and South America. Those people believed that the extraterrestrials, what they called greys like Balaam or Enlil, had guided civilization in those days.
Well, we know those people were right. So why was Djoser important?
He was the first pharaoh to unite Upper and Lower Egypt. When he had his pyramid built, he...
It was 6 mastabas tall. Did I tell you that already?
No, you didn't tell me that. How could you know that? Only 4 of the mastabas were surviving at the end of the 20th century.
Because I saw it in the damn dream.
Kane swallowed reflexively, finding it harder to do since they'd been without water all morning long. Adults had to watch their children to make sure they didn't try to drink from the pools of acid rain that occupied the hollows of the land.
Are you sure you've never seen the pyramid anywhere before?
Kane struggled to keep the irritation from his voice. If he hadn't been sure that he had never seen the pyramid before yesterday, he would have said so.
Baptiste, I'm not an archivist. All the material I've been exposed to regarding pyramids has been while I was with you. Back in Koboldville, reading about pyramids never happened. I was a magistrate. I wasn't there to read. I don't think even Lakesh has droned on about anyone named Djoser.
I just thought maybe you had seen a book on Egyptology while you were at Cerberus.
No.
Bridget nodded.
Djoser wasn't the name scholars knew this pharaoh by. He was also called Net-Jeriket, and that is the name he is best known by. It wasn't uncommon for a pharaoh to have 5 or more names.
I haven't heard anything about that name either.
The Grande River ran narrow and shallow, farther ahead and to the west, like a bright ribbon laid through the overgrown forest. The road meandered down the side of the valley and disappeared into the trees when it hit level ground. There were no vills, and no one else moving on the road as far as Kane could see.
Was there anything in the materials that you've read about some kind of machine that Djoser had?
What kind of machine?
I don't know what kind of machine, Baptiste. If I knew already, I wouldn't have all these questions.
Even given your description of the machine, I can't place it.
Kane had drawn it out for her, as best he remembered from the dream, in a smoothed-over patch of ground near the gnarled sycamore tree they'd kept watch by. Bridget had confirmed that she had never seen anything like the machine.
Balaam was there in your dream.
Yes.
But you said that you had the impression that Balaam didn't belong there.
He didn't.
Because he knew you weren't Canacht? You don't think it was a dream, do you?
Kane hesitated a moment, then shook his head. Analgesics had dimmed the pounding in his head somewhat, but the unexplained fever from the previous night had left him incredibly thirsty.
No, I don't.
Then what was it?
I have no idea, Baptiste.
Well, now we know what happened to the motorcyclist.
Grant stood near the body, his copperhead canted over one broad shoulder.
Poor bastard never made it in out of the rain.
Kane peered down at the corpse. She had been a young woman with mousy brown hair, but he had no idea what she had looked like or what age she'd been. The acid rain had burned and seared her flesh, bubbling it up in places. It also ate holes through her clothing.
You think she was lost?
Domi knelt quickly and started going through the dead woman's clothing. She found a necklace that featured a beaten silver heart wrapped over a blue stone. Without any hesitation in the slightest, the albino took the necklace and placed the jewelry around her own neck. The blue stone glittered at the hollow of her throat. Kane witnessed the pilfering, but didn't say anything. To Domi's mind, the small theft from the dead woman wasn't a theft at all. It was accepting a legacy and a piece of good fortune.
Lost. Or running. Judging by the jewelry, I'd say she was running.
Grant knelt and slipped his combat knife from his boot. He pushed the sleeve of the jacket the dead woman was wearing back to reveal the iron band around her left wrist. Domi pushed the sleeve back on the other arm and exposed the iron bracelet there, too.
Slave! Must have broke free and stole motorcycle!
One of the men in the group spoke up.
Maybe she was running for Fiddlerville. Everybody around these parts has heard about Fiddlerville and how you can catch a ship to Campecheville from there.
Kane stared at the dead woman, thinking if everybody knew about a mass escape route in a land full of slavers, it probably wasn't a good thing. Slavers would view an escaped slave as lost profits, while the barons would view an escaped slave as a reduction in the potential labor force to aid in rebuilding and refortifying their vills. And everybody seemed to know about the enemy camp that lay at the end of the path they currently followed.
She not running. She hunting.
The albino opened the scarred leather saddlebags tied down to the motorcycle. Inside the saddlebags were boxes of ammo and 3 hand blasters.
Must have been in a hurry if she didn't bother to lose the bracelets. They would have marked her to anyone who saw them.
She was out in the storm. She must have thought what she was doing was important, and she had little time to do it.
Grant nodded, then looked down the muddy, rutted road.
Makes you wonder what we've got waiting up ahead.
Kane looked down at the motorcycle.
Maybe we should take a look first.
The old military-equipped Enduro had a high chassis set inches above the ground. The exhaust pipes ran along the left side.
The motorcycle looks like it's all in one piece.
Handlebars look a little crooked.
Grant turned and looked back at the skid marks that led up to the motorcycle.
Looks like she rode it as far as she could go, then the acid rain got to be too much and she rode it down to the ground.
After a few minutes of cleaning the carburetor using tools they found under the motorcycle's seat, Kane threw a leg over the motorcycle and pumped the kickstart up to full prime. Then he kicked again, turning the engine over. The motorcycle started with a hearty roar. Black smoke poured from the exhaust and created a minor smoke screen. Kane checked the fuel tank and found it half full. From the smell, he guessed that the fuel was homegrown and alcohol-based. That kind of fuel was hard on engines, but it would get the job done as long as proper maintenance was conducted. Grant stood in front of the motorcycle and grabbed the handlebars. Kane loosened the handlebar retaining screw, let Grant realign the handlebars, and tightened it back down.
I'll go see how far Fiddlerville is and find out what's waiting up ahead.
Might be better if you had some company.
I'll go.
Kane hesitated, not knowing what to say and not knowing what would set off an argument between them. Grant came to his rescue.
Bridget, it would be better if you stayed with me and let Domi go.
Why?
Because if someone in the village is keeping watch on people, I fit in better than you.
The albino crossed her arms over her breasts. For a moment, Kane thought Bridget was going to put up an argument. Then Bridget shook her head.
You're right.
Kane secured the M14 across the motorcycle's handlebars with leather straps, tied for quick release so he could get the rifle loose quickly if he needed it. He wore the .45 on his hip openly. None of the people in the group with them had ever been to Fiddlerville, and he wanted to be prepared for anything. Having Domi along also increased his chances. She had been raised in the Outlands. He held the motorcycle steady while Domi climbed on. The albino wrapped her arms around Kane and leaned her body against his. She also insisted on carrying the .357 Magnum pistol in one hand so it would be ready. The presence of the big pistol pointed in the region of his groin was somewhat disconcerting to Kane, but having the weapon ready might prove handy. Kane twisted the accelerator and released the clutch. The motorcycle's rear tire bit into the loose mud of the road and shot forward. Although he didn't prefer travel by motorcycle, Kane was adept at driving them. He ran the gearbox quickly and efficiently, getting the feel for the powerful Enduro. He kept his mind on the road, aware that the noise of the motorcycle engine would alert other people they were in the area, and also that game could run out into the road before him. But part of his thoughts replayed the dreams he had had of Egypt and of Balaam. Kane came upon Fiddlerville almost unexpectedly, even though he had been looking for it. The ville was located at the base of red clay foothills, scarred by dozens of years of runoff water. Deep trenches looked as if they had been hacked into the land with a dull axe. Spotting the ville spread out across the harsh, broken terrain below, Kane pulled the motorcycle to the side of the road and kept driving through the underbrush until he reached a copse of trees that provided shelter as well as cover. He knew there was a chance that the motorcycle had already been overheard, but he didn't want to go down into Fiddlerville without doing at least some recon. He took the mini binoculars from inside the war bag he and Domi had brought with them. With the albino drifting behind him as silently as a ghost and totally at home in the forest, Kane made his way farther up into the foothills. The sun was starting to descend in the west now, and he knew there was almost no chance at all of accidentally catching a reflection from the binoculars' lenses. Focusing the binoculars, he scanned the ville, working patiently and thoroughly. Fiddlerville was a hodgepodge of broken and tumble-down buildings. Rubble lay scattered across cracked and buckled streets, and even though there were dozens of wags on the streets, none of them remained intact. All of them had been stripped over the years, and the salty mist that rolled in from the gulf had ground them down to rusting heaps. The few people who moved through the ville were all armed. Scanning the buildings, Kane spotted three machine gun nests that roughly triangulated the central area of the buildings that had been restored enough for people to live in.
Some people look like slaves, maybe.
Maybe they're there waiting on the next ship.
He trained the binoculars on the natural harbor that lay just south of Fiddlerville. White-capped waves rolled in from the gulf, smooth as spun glass. 8 fishing vessels sat at anchor, but the crews aboard the ships stayed busy cleaning the day's catch. Once they were clean, children carried fillets to the shore, where they were smoked and could be later used to trade and barter with. There were no big ships in the harbor, but ironworks towers stood along the beach. More machine gunners occupied the towers and had overlapping fields of fire.
Machine gun nests on beach. Not just for protecting fishermen.
Kane didn't believe so either. The ragged line of towers formed a shore defense zone. He glanced at the open beach at either end of the docks. The sea encroached deeply into the land, and the beach was rough, laced with craggy earth and broken rocks. A pile of wags lay halfway submerged to the east, probably towed there by the people who cleaned the vill. As Kane watched, a man hitched a team of mules to one of the wags on a street that was partially cleared. The mules dug in and pulled the broken-down wag into motion. The tires had been gone for years, leaving only rusty metal rims that had frozen up and wouldn't turn. Screeching metal filled the air and reached Kane's ears.
What we do? Getting tired standing around here. I'm thirsty. They got Gaudy down there. We go down. Look around closer.
Kane nodded. At the very least, they needed water. And if the vill proved safe enough, they could drop the group off there and go on about the business of finding the way into Campecheville. Kane stayed aware of the stares he and Domi drew as he drove the motorcycle through Fiddlerville streets. He was also aware that he was never out of the field of fire of one of the machine gun nests that overlooked the vill itself. One wrong move and there would be no safety in those streets. He brought the motorcycle to a stop in front of the Gaudy. It was a 3-story red brick structure with cracked walls and broken windows covered with plywood. The sign over the double doors proudly proclaimed Chantilly Lacey's. The sign was faded, but it still showed the picture of a masked woman dressed in a silver and purple bikini. The masked woman held a futuristic hand blaster with telescopic sights in a 2-handed ready stance. Kane nodded to Domi, signaling her to get off the motorcycle. When she did, he rolled the motorcycle backward and parked it so that it faced out into the street for a quick getaway, if one became necessary. He also chose to place the bike between 2 tall 4-wheel drive wags that would provide temporary cover. Glancing around, even making sure to look up directly at the machine gun nest that covered the front of Chantilly Lacey's, Kane let everyone watching him know that he was aware of the stakes. Domi waited on the cracked and buckled sidewalk in front of the Gaudy. The anticipatory smile on her face was real. The albino loved the comfortable accommodations available at the Cerberus Redoubt, but she was in her element when she was in the Outlands. She holstered her .357 Magnum pistol with a spinning flourish that was straight out of the Old West gunfighters that Grant had taught her about. The obvious experience with the weapon was not lost on the spectators. Kane took a moment and untied the M14. He rested his finger alongside the trigger guard and walked with the rifle pointing toward the ground. He nodded to Domi, signaling her to go ahead. Men's eyes would linger on her before they moved on to Kane, and it would give him a little more time to size up them and the situation. Inside the Gaudy, oil lanterns fought back the gloom fostered by the covered windows. The smell of unwashed flesh lingered amid the scents of homemade lye soap and malt liquors and beers. Cheap homegrown tobacco also filled the air, and smoky clouds wreathed the Gaudy's interior. He swept the room with a glance that was pure magistrate. He had worn the look often while dressed in the black polycarbonate armor. It was both challenge and warning. Domi made her way to the bar. The bartender was a broad, squared-off man with a shaved head and a fierce red goatee. Savage tattoos of green and purple geckos twined together in various sexual positions covered his face and arms. Silver earrings and his nose ring caught the light of the lanterns hanging over the bar. Bottles lined the shelves behind the bartender and were reflected in the mirrored tiles that covered the walls.
Well, you have, pretty lady.
Domi leaned on the bar, resting on her elbows and getting close to the bartender. Kane knew she was aware that she had the attention of nearly every man in the Gaudy. He raked the establishment with an experienced eye, knowing no place like this existed without someone who was in charge.
Where you get water?
The bartender reached for a glass mug from a stack at the end of the bar. He took it down and wiped it with a bar towel.
Got wells. Natural wells. About 10 clicks north of the vill.
Storm brought acid rain last night. Wells maybe not so healthy.
This one is, pretty lady. I promise.
The bartender gave Domi a wink, then reached under the bar and brought out a 5-gallon see-through glass container.
Don't understand everything that was explained to me, but I know that we have limestone over that well. Rain comes down, but it filters through that limestone, leaves all the bad stuff behind. Time the water reaches the well 100 feet down, it's as pure as water gets.
He poured, then pushed the filled mug over to Domi. Domi glanced into the mirrored tiles behind the bartender and locked eyes with Kane.
If this stuff makes me sick, chill this stoop bastard.
Consider it done.
Kane lifted the M14 in one hand and pointed it at the bartender's head. The bartender held up his hands in consternation.
Hey, now wait a damn minute. There's a nothing wrong with...
Domi lifted the mug and drank until it was empty. She set the mug back on the wooden bar with a loud bang that echoed over the gaudy, then wiped her lips with the back of her sleeve.
Water's fine. Could be colder.
The bartender mopped his face with his bar towel in relief.
Fuck, mister. I thought you was gonna blow my damn head off.
I still might. The water hasn't made it through her system yet.
Domi grinned.
I let you know when it does.
Suddenly, 3 men appeared along the catwalk that ringed the second floor and peered down onto the first floor. All of the men had Ingram submachine guns cradled in their hands and wore Kevlar vests.
That will be enough of that.
Kane glanced up at the speaker. The woman looked to be in her early 30s. She was petite and svelte, and her hair was striped in pale green and frost. She wore lime green vinyl pants that looked painted on, and a dark blue crop top left her flat belly exposed. A jade gem gleamed in her belly button.
Are you trying to get yourself chilled?
No. I just wanted to meet the man in charge.
Domi calmly drank the second mug of water and watched the action unfold as though it were something she did every day.
It's not a man.
The woman grabbed hold of the railing in front of her and leaned forward. She wore a big pistol in a cross-draw flap holster on her left hip.
It's a lady in charge of this gaudy.
Chantilly Lacey?
The woman smiled.
Not hardly. You can call me Fiddler.
Kane grinned and slowly pulled the M14 back over his shoulder so the men watching him could clearly see that his finger wasn't inside the trigger guard.
It's not the gaudy named after you. It's the whole vill.
Fiddler shrugged.
I built the vill, so I felt obliged to name the vill. I wanted to name it something that I could remember.
She gazed at Kane with open interest.
I end up meeting most folks who travel through this vill. I especially get to know the ones who are trouble, or who pass through here more than once. We're not exactly on the beaten path.
That's not what I hear. I've been told that if I want to escape slavers, I can come to Fiddlerville and catch a ship to a place called Campecheville.
You don't look like an escaped slave.
I'm not, but I do have 16 people who are, thinking they can get a ship out of here. Maybe I should go back to them and tell them they're wrong.
The woman pushed off of the railing and stood on her own 2 feet as she gazed down at Kane. It took her a moment to reach what she evidently considered to be an important decision.
16 people?
Yeah. 5 of them are children.
Did they have something set up before now?
With who?
Me and the captain of the ship that's going to take them out of here.
No. They were coming because they had heard about Campecheville. Slavers took them a few days back.
How did they get free?
They had help.
Fiddler raised an eyebrow.
You?
And some friends.
The woman turned her direct gaze onto Domi. The albino raised her mug of water in a silent toast. Fiddler glanced back at Kane.
What made you become involved in the plight of a few slaves?
I never much cared for slavery.
Fiddler waved at the 3 men with Ingram submachine guns. The 3 men stepped back from the railing and turned their weapons away.
Join me. I've got a suite of rooms on this floor. We can talk.